Coming up next from the movie Jesus, Sermon on the Plain.
Blessed are you, poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you who hunger now, for you shall be filled. Blessed are you who weep now, for you shall laugh. Blessed are you when men hate you and reject you and insult you and say you are evil, all because of the Son of Man. Be glad when that happens and dance for joy, because a great reward is kept for you in heaven, for their ancestors did the very same things to the prophets.
That's all I've got.
What do you mean that's all you've got?
How terrible for you who are rich now. You have had your easy life.
He doesn't want to be rich. He must be mad.
How terrible for you who laugh now. For you shall mourn and weep. How terrible when all men speak well of you. For their ancestors said the very same things about the false prophets. But I tell you who hear me, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. And pray for those who mistreat you. If anyone strikes you on the one cheek, let him hit the other one also. And if someone takes away your coat, let him have your shirt as well. Give to everyone who begs from you. And if someone takes what is yours, do not ask for it back again. Do for others only what you would have others do for you. If you love only the people who love you, why should you receive a blessing? For even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who do good to you, why should you receive a blessing? Even sinners do that.
How could he touch her? How could he talk to her?
Disgusting. No. Love your enemies and do good to them and lend expecting nothing back. And then you will have a great reward, for you will be sons of the Most High God. For he is good to the ungrateful and to the wicked. Be merciful, just as your Father is merciful.
Save us, Jesus!
Judge not and you will not be judged. Condemn not. And you will not be condemned. Forgive, and you will be forgiven.
Lead us in thy path, O Lord.
Give, and it will be given to you. For the measure you give will be the measure you get back. One blind man cannot lead another. If he does, they will both fall into a ditch. Why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but pay no attention to the log in your own eye?
Guide us, O Master.
We need you now, Lord. How happy is the mother that bore you and nursed you.
Rather, how happy are those who hear the word of God and obey it.
I'd like to know this man.
Do you think he might be the Messiah?
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining us, we're listening to Howard Zinn and The Myth of the Good Wars, and he's talking about Pearl Harbor and the beginning of World War II.
And when you look into the history, and this, none of this is to absolve Japan, you know, at all, of cruelty and what they did in China and so on. But the fact is that without subscribing to the theory that, oh, Roosevelt orchestrated and knew. Well, actually, the United States government knew that the Japanese were planning to attack us. And they also knew that Pearl Harbor was a likely place. So it's not that they knew that, oh, exactly on December 7th, these warplanes would come over and attack Pearl Harbor. But it wasn't simply we were there, innocents, and had no idea, and this is a surprise attack. It wasn't totally a surprise. There was an admiral who before Pearl Harbor, said, you know, why are we concentrating our Navy at Pearl Harbor? Why don't we withdraw from Pearl Harbor? May we make it an inviting target? you know, we don't need it. It's a possession of ours. That admiral was removed from duty. Really. So there's a lot of history behind, you know, the Japanese were not simply an unsolicited and unprovoked attack on Pearl Harbor. And again, I'm not defending the attack on Pearl Harbor, yes. Although I might say it was an attack on a military target as opposed to the attacks we then leveled on Japan, which were not on military targets, but on civilian targets, like the bombing of Tokyo in the spring of 45, when we kill 100,000 people in Tokyo in one night. How many Americans know about that? They know about Hiroshima. They may know about Dresden. Do they know about Tokyo in the spring of 45? 100,000? Anyway, so the Pearl Harbor is more complicated. And the question is, so what do you do if they attack Pearl Harbor? Well, maybe you don't declare war. Maybe you withdraw. Okay, it's not our colony anymore. It's your colony.
Well.
At different stages of the development of this thing, you have to figure at each stage what do you do, you know, and what do you do to minimize, what do you do to try to represent something moral and at the same time minimize the human cost of whatever you do. I mean, it's not just Pearl Harbor. Oh, Hitler goes into Poland. Well, he wants certain things. If we had given him those things, we gave him Czechoslovakia, right? Oh, appeasement. What if we had also given him Poland? This is, nobody likes to say this. I mean, it's a no-no. I mean, you know, it's treason, really. But you have to ask questions that haven't been asked. You have to be willing to question everything. And, okay, all right, here's Poland. Here, take this, take that, take this, take that, take. Hey, how much can you take? And at what point are your forces spread thin? And at what point do you stop being able to control the situation? Even during World War II, Hitler was not able to control the outlying districts of his new empire. He was not able to control events in Norway or Bulgaria. Bulgaria could say to him, we're not, as they did, we're not going to send these Jews to Auschwitz, and he had to go along with it. This is what happens with empires. Empires expand, and then at a certain point, they lose power, they lose control, and they begin to disintegrate. It takes longer, of course, for that to happen than if you fight a war and get rid of that evil empire. We don't know what might have happened, right? You're saying, we have no idea what Hitler would have done, right? We know what terrible things he might have done. And it's true. But what happens then is you justify the atrocities that you commit by the frightening thought of what atrocities the other side may commit. And it's a very common defense of an immoral act, that it's done to prevent another immoral act. And you take Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which is an example of that. Why? How? Talk about an immoral act. I mean, next to Auschwitz, let us say, okay, let's put that aside. But in the whole scheme of immoral acts, Hiroshima and Nagasaki rank near the top of immoral acts. To kill several hundred thousand innocent people deliberately. Why? To prevent something worse, right? What do they say? We did to prevent, to save lives. And it's interesting. We didn't kill a couple of hundred thousand people in order to save lives.
American lives.
Huh? American lives. Oh, that's the difference. No, really, that's the difference, American lives. If I had said to somebody when we were discussing this thing, would you be willing in August of 1945, if you could shorten the war, because that's what we did, right? with a bomb. We shortened the war. The war was going to come to an end, but we shortened it with a bomb. Would you be willing, in order to shorten the war, to kill 100,000 American children? Well, the answer is obvious. How about 100,000 Japanese children? That's what we did. What does that mean? What does that say about us?
It was a question of several tens of thousands of American soldiers occupying the islands. That was the question, not children in that situation.
The argument is we would have had to invade Japan, and in the invasion of Japan, and then numbers were thrown around wildly. Truman, who is not a very good mathematician, not good at a lot of things, a million people in the invasion of Japan, a million people. No, there were no military estimates, estimates by the military who were planning the invasion of Japan. No estimates by them of a million. No, their estimate actually was maybe 35,000 would die in the invasion. However, there's something more important than that. No invasion was necessary. We did not have to invade Japan in order to win the war. The evidence for that is very powerful. I recommend to you that you read the most exhaustive bit of research that was done on the dropping of the bomb by Gar Alperovitz called The Decision to Drop the Bomb. No, there was no need to invade Japan. And so when they talk about a million lives are saved, or even 35,000 lives, not true. And in the course of it, we killed several hundred thousand people in order to quickly win the war. Instead of waiting maybe weeks, a month, 3 months, the U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey, which our official survey that went into Japan after the war and interviewed all the officials and went over all the evidence, and they came to the conclusion Japan would have surrendered within several months without any dropping of the atomic bomb. So we were in a hurry. And of course, there are interesting questions to raise. Why were we in such a hurry? They're really willing to sacrifice so many lives.
Hear great speeches and interviews at AXA Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. Coming up next, from the movie Romero, Archbishop Oscar Romero orders the army to stop the repression of the people.
I'd like to make an appeal in a special way to the men in the army. Brothers, each one of you is one of us. We are the same people. The farmers and peasants that you kill are your own brothers and sisters. When you hear the words of a man telling you to kill, think instead in the words of God, "Thou shalt not kill." No soldier is obliged to obey an order contrary to the law of God. In his name, and in the name of our tormented people who have suffered so much and whose laments cry out to heaven, I implore you, I beg you, I order you, stop the repression!
Coming up next, atmospheric scientist Virabhatran Ramanathan talks about various ways to solve the problems of climate change.
Despite the threat of climate change, society has struggled to control its emissions of greenhouse gases. But now a so-called second front in climate change mitigation has emerged and revived hopes that the most dangerous consequences of climate change can at least be delayed for several decades. It turns out that about 40% of current global warming can be attributed to four pollutants: methane, black carbon, ozone, and refrigerants. Virabhatran Ramanathan and his colleagues have shown that by reducing the emission of these pollutants with currently available technologies, society can reduce the rate of warming by as much as 50% during our lifetimes. This could help slow down the melting of Himalayan glaciers and Arctic sea ice, as well as slowing sea level rise. A UN study prompted by Ramanathan's finding additionally found that control measures could save as many as 4 million lives a year through improvements to public health. The study also found that agricultural yields would improve. Ramanathan sees the concept as a win-win that helps people improve the quality of their lives while addressing a global problem. But like many scientists, he knows there are limits to how much he can tell people what to do. Late in his career, he has explored ways to get his message across without sacrificing his scientific authority. In 2007, he adopted a new outlook when his empirical and humanitarian worlds collided.
Early 2007, March, this meeting was organized by United Nations and was primarily for high school students from around the world. And it was held in the same meeting hall where the UN General Assembly is held. And I gave this talk about global warming and what we should do, how we can mitigate some of the disastrous changes. And at the end of my talk, there were, you know, several questions, but one of them was from a student from Africa. I don't know exactly which country she was from. And she said, "Professor Ramanathan, you made such a passionate case that we should cut down global warming. Tell me what you are doing personally." And just, I was speechless. I had nothing to tell her, because until that point, I had not done anything personally. And that had just a such an aha moment for me, and changed my life in many ways. I said, next time I meet her, I need to be able to tell her something.
Ramanathan is a distinguished climate and atmospheric scientist at Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego. In a new phase of his career, he is combining science with social action. It has taken him beyond academia and journals. Over time, he has brought his message to legislators and even religious leaders, people who can reach society in ways he can't. In 2004, he accepted an invitation from Pope John Paul II to join the elite Pontifical Academy of Sciences, joining 80 other international scientists on issues of interest to the Catholic Church.
It was when I discovered that as scientists, we don't have the moral authority to tell people what to do. Even to the effect of telling people you should cut your CO2 emissions, or you should do this, or you should do that. But spiritual leaders do. That's what religions have, that moral authority. So it was, to me, a personal realization that as a community, we have not tapped into an important source for, you know, solving some of our environmental problems. Use the moral authority of the religious spiritual leaders.
In April 2012, Ramanathan received a special chance to interact with another religious leader with global clout when the 14th Dalai Lama visited San Diego. Ramanathan addressed the mutual duty of scientists and spiritual leaders in steering societal action, but it was afterwards that he received the surprise of a lifetime.
About a year ago is when I get a call from Scripps director's office saying, would I be interested in participating in an event with the Dalai Lama? To me, it was just a call from heaven. And of course, I said yes. It was a big public event, and with close to a few thousand. And myself and another colleague, Professor Somerville, were involved in a dialogue with the Dalai Lama. And I took the opportunity to talk about this, that we can do something now about climate change, as leaders are still entangled in the CO2 issue to cut down the shortly pollutants. And that message was received quite well by the Dalai Lama and the public. But the best was yet to come. So after the event, which lasted about an hour and 10 minutes, he turned around, held my hand here, and he said, I am going to work on this problem for the rest of my life. And you can just imagine. Honestly, I would say I was a lot more excited, was really euphoric, much more than when my science paper was accepted 37 years ago.
I think his humanitarian concerns were always there. And I think he had a belief that if he just did his science and it was good enough, that people would see its quality as he did and see its importance as he did, and then it would automatically flow into social benefit. It didn't happen that way. Even his closest colleagues didn't recognize the value of the short-lived climate pollutants for quite a while. They understood its quality of the work, but not the value. And so I think as time passed, he realized that he had to carry his work farther and persuade people, actively persuade them of the social and human importance of the work that he was doing. And this regard took a step that a lot of scientists wouldn't, because once you get into this public arena, you can, of course, be accused of being biased and have an interest in certainly in many cases that's justified. And in this case, he has an interest too, but it's the welfare of humanity.
Ramanathan also achieved a personal breakthrough in translating his science to policy. He did so by reaching out to social scientists and economists, people well-versed in the worlds of governance and diplomacy. He established strong ties with United Nations officials and began advocating his strategy for slowing down climate change in foreign policy journals.
I had published over 30, 40 papers on this topic for the last 35 years. But I didn't realize the power of publishing in journals which policymakers read. So we wrote a paper in 2009, teaming up with another scientist, and then the United Nations did an assessment of this problem. In my view, the whole thing culminated on February 16th of 2012.
In February 2012, U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton announced a multinational initiative to control emissions of short-lived climate pollutants, the climate change agents that Ramanathan had spent 40 years uncovering.
So when we discover effective and affordable ways to reduce global warming, not just a little, but by a lot, it is a call to action for all of us. Pollutants such as methane, black carbon or soot, hydrofluorocarbons. In the past few years, we've learned that this group contributes much more to climate change than we previously realized. More than one-third of current global warming is caused by short-lived pollutants.
Now, it's a small beginning, but we hope that it will grow. If you look at the situation, not from the science community's point of view, but say from the world of international politics or the media, you see 20 years of effort on climate change at the public level, and it hasn't succeeded. And so the minute that people learn that there are other things that you can't do, that you can do about it, and you aren't doing it, a lot of people are going to conclude this problem isn't serious. And so by taking action now and doing what you can do now, you convince people it's a serious problem. We're starting to work on it. And it's also very significant that the United States took the lead. The United States of America took the lead on a climate issue.
So this whole approach of cutting down the short-lived climate pollutants to protect our generation and our children's generation, and in the next 10, 20 years, starting to reduce the CO2 to protect our grandchildren, such that we leave behind a planet pretty close to the one we inherited, at least I inherited, 65 years ago. That planet, I know from personal observations, was a lot cleaner than what we see now.
In Ramanathan's fourth decade of climate study, he has found himself as a catalyst for socioeconomic change. In his own field, however, his legacy has already been cast.
He is clearly at the same level as Scripps' greatest scientists historically. There is a pantheon of three at the present time that have had a profound effect on their discipline in the science: Roger Revelle, Dave Keeling, Walter Monk. And I think 20 years from now they will put Ram as the fourth on that list.
There's no question about the fact that he has just made major contributions to the field. It's clear that there are a few climate scientists, if you will, whose names will be remembered for quite a long time. And it's clear also that Ram is in that category.
Tumble out of bed and I stumble to the kitchen. Pour myself a cup of ambition and yawn and stretch and try to come to life. Jump in the shower and the blood starts pumping. Out on the street, the traffic starts jumping. With folks like me on the job from 9 to 5. Working 9 to 5. What a way to make a living, barely getting by. It's all taking and no giving. They just use your mind and they never give you credit. It's enough to drive you crazy as you like. ladder. You're just a step on the boss man's ladder, but you've got dreams he'll never take away. You're in the same boat with a lot of your friends, waiting for the day your ship will come in and the tide's gonna turn and it's all gonna roll your way. Working nights.
That's all, folks.